peace with justice means pursuing the security of a world without nuclear weapons, no matter how distant that dream may be. And so, as president, I've strengthened our efforts to stop the spread of nuclear weapons and reduce the number and role of America's nuclear weapons. Because of the New START treaty, we're on track to cut American and Russian deployed nuclear warheads to their lowest levels since the 1950s.
They advocate for maintaining a safe, secure, reliable deterrence through this proposed campaign, because it might not necessarily happen, proposed campaign of nuclear reductions.
Tonight, local independent researcher Alicia Dressman returns to the show to talk about nuclear weapons policy. Stand by for Tell Somebody. www.tellsomebody.us, on Twitter at TellSomebodyNow. This is your host, Tom Clammer. If you have any comments or questions on this show, drop us a line at mail@tellsomebody.us. That's mail@tellsomebody.us. The podcast of last week's show with FBI whistleblower Colleen Rowley talking about whistleblower Edward Snowden and whistleblowing generally is now online. Go to tellsomebody.us and click on a tile for a link to listen to that or other past shows. The June 18, 2013 edition of the Wall Street Journal had an article about the new Kansas City nuclear weapons parts plant operated by Honeywell, owned by the Planned Industrial Expansion Authority of Kansas City and leased to the federal government by private developer CenterPoint Zimmer in a complicated deal. The article was titled "Lease Aims at Big Savings," and starts out saying, "Sometimes you have to spend money to save money. That is what some federal government officials are saying as they move workers into a new $863.1 million manufacturing complex built using a rare lease deal with a private venture. In the deal, the U.S. General Services Administration agreed to lease five buildings on a new 185-acre campus in Kansas City, Missouri, for $61.5 million annually for the next 20 years. And the Wall Street Journal article goes on saying, "The buildings are owned by a venture of CenterPoint Properties Trust, an Oak Brook, Illinois firm controlled by the California Public Employees Retirement System and Zimmer Real Estate Services, LLC of Kansas City." Close quote. Actually, the property is owned by the Kansas City Planned Industrial Expansion Authority, a body that Kansas City Mayor Sly James has claimed is not a city agency, even though their board is appointed by the Kansas City Mayor and their activities require approval by the Kansas City, Missouri City Council, and Mayor James is now trying to dictate that the PIEA, the not a city agency, consolidate with other development agencies under the Kansas City Economic Development Corporation umbrella. The Wall Street Journal article continues, Although the federal government owns the nuclear agency's current space, part of a nearby facility known as the Bannister Federal Complex, the nuclear agency said it will save about $100 million annually by moving about 2,500 workers and contractors into the new rental space. It continues, the new complex was financed in 2010 using $697.7 million in bonds, $114.5 million from the GSA for one-time tenant improvements, $37 million in equity from CenterPoint, and $13.9 million from the state and local governments. As part of the deal, the CenterPoint venture earns a $20 million development fee. CenterPoint also will take ownership of the land in the complex at the end of the 20-year lease. Close quote. But the deal proudly touted in the article was rather harshly criticized in an October 2009 GAO report to the Subcommittee on Energy and Water Development Committee on Appropriations of the U.S. Senate titled, National Nuclear Security Administration Needs to Better Manage Risks Associated with Modernization of its Kansas City plant, saying, because the KC plant's analysis did not consider costs beyond 20 years, NNSA cannot be certain if other alternatives, such as purchasing the facility, might have offered lower costs over the longer term. I tried to get an up-to-date response to the Wall Street Journal story from the GAO, but got no reply to email and voicemail messages left with them. And another article, the Kansas City Business Journal was among members of the compliant media invited to a public relations tour of secure portions of the new Kansas City nuclear weapons parts plant last Thursday, as recounted in a June 28th article. Exclusive look inside the new National Security Administration campus. In the article, a Honeywell spokesman was quoted as saying, the workers have a collective 60,000 years of experience, which is crucial to maintain weapons as old as Winston Churchill's Iron Curtain speech and as young as Ronald Reagan's Tear Down This Wall speech. 2 weeks ago, President Obama spoke about nuclear weapons in Berlin.
Peace with justice means pursuing the security of a world without nuclear weapons, no matter how distant that dream may be. And so as president, I've strengthened our efforts to stop the spread of nuclear weapons and reduce the number and role of America's nuclear weapons. Because of the New START treaty, we're on track to cut American and Russian deployed nuclear warheads to their lowest levels since the 1950s. But we have more work to do. So today I'm announcing additional steps forward. After a comprehensive review, I've determined that we can ensure the security of America and our allies and maintain a strong and credible strategic deterrent while reducing our deployed strategic nuclear weapons by up to one-third. And I intend to seek negotiated cuts with Russia to move beyond Cold War nuclear postures. At the same time, we'll work with our NATO allies to seek bold reductions in U.S. and Russian tactical weapons in Europe. And we can forge a new international framework for peaceful nuclear power, reject the nuclear weaponization that North Korea and Iran may be seeking. America will host a summit in 2016 to continue our efforts to secure nuclear materials around the world, and we will work to build support in the United States to ratify the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty and call on all nations to begin negotiations on a treaty that ends the production of fissile materials for nuclear weapons. These are steps we can take to create a world of peace with justice.
President Obama speaking in Berlin last month. Alicia Dressman has been closely following both the global and the local Kansas City issues related to nuclear weapons. She appeared on this show shortly after the April 8, 2010 signing in Prague of the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, otherwise known as the New START Treaty, between the U.S. and the Russian Federation. It has the formal name, Measures for the Further Reduction and Limitation of Strategic Offensive Arms. And I spoke with Alicia Dressman again on Saturday. Give a listen. Alicia Dressman is a freelance researcher. Alicia, welcome back to Tell Somebody.
It's wonderful to be here, Tom.
So, President Obama gave a speech in Berlin a couple of weeks ago related to nuclear weapons. What basically did he have to say there?
What Obama was trying to achieve when he took the dais in Berlin, a continuation of his work with the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty in the first term of his administration, and he is endeavoring to reduce America's nuclear arsenal in concert with the Russian Federation. So although many of the Senate GOP interpreted his statement as calling for drastic unilateral reductions, this is actually a part of an effort to engage the Russians in further bilateral reductions. And that was the crux of his speech. There was also discussion afterwards in guidance that was delivered from the administration, new guidance on the role of nuclear weapons in defense policy in the 21st century.
Okay, so that's what he was trying to put forth in his speech. How, in your view, does that comport with reality of what's going on with nuclear weapons in the United States?
Well, almost to, as if to preempt anxiety about Obama's commitment to a reliable deterrent, the National Nuclear Security Administration issued its Stockpiled Stewardship Management Plan for fiscal year 2013, the Tuesday before he gave the speech. And this multi-year plan for the next 30 fiscal years outlines, amongst other things, three life extension programs for interoperable warheads that can be delivered on more than one platform, so on intercontinental ballistic missile and on a submarine launched ballistic missile. And these life extension programs for all legs of the triad will total near $64 billion. So this is, I guess, is what I see as Obama's strategy for achieving nuclear reductions while sustaining an arsenal, while sustaining the nuclear triad, which, you know, it seems like this arsenal still has the capability of defeating a Cold War adversary, and we're still dealing with an outdated mission.
So we have a Nobel Peace Prize winning president giving this speech in Berlin after other speeches, a lot of talking about shrinking the nuclear arsenals, but we're still spending a lot more money on them, including what's going on in Kansas City. Is that right?
That's right. And the cost of these programs has been flagged by the Senate Energy and Water Appropriations Committee in its report on the Energy and Water Appropriations Bill. They are very concerned, given the NNSA's failure at cost estimates with the B-61 gravity bomb life extension program. They perceived certain challenges with the NNSA to make these life extension programs affordable, the example here being the B-61 gravity bomb life extension program, which ballooned from $4 billion to $10 billion over just a couple of years. And more important, in reference to the B-61 LEP, on time, on schedule, achieving project milestones. So they see that as happening with all of these life extension programs that are outlined in the Stockpile Stewardship Management program. And they say, okay, so we're here, we're the Appropriations Committee, you're asking us for money. We want to see better performance with cost estimates, but then also when it comes to the projects, with achieving project milestones, even the easiest critics, so to speak, which would be Senate Armed Services Committee or Senate Energy and Water Appropriations, are starting to voice some criticism of these projects.
And you've talked before we started recording about B-61, W-78, W-88. Can you tell our listeners what those are?
Oh, certainly. The B-61 warhead is a warhead that is deployed on a long-range bomber. So,
and say it's a model of a nuclear bomb. It's suited to the bomber rather than to the missile.
Right. It would never be deployed on a missile. The W-78 is a warhead that is deployed on an intercontinental ballistic missile. And then the W-88 is a warhead that is deployed on a Trident missile. So you have, that's actually a great example of the triad. You have your air-based warhead, which would be the B-61 warhead. You have your land-based warhead, which would be the W-78, which is deployed on, again, on the ICBM. And then you have your sea-based W-88, which is deployed on a Trident missile. It goes on a Trident instead, like the Ohio-class submarine.
And you mentioned life extension programs. These are, we've had nuclear weapons since World War II ended, and some of what the stockpile is have been around not that long, but quite a while, and the spin, at least, is that we just want to make sure these are safe. Is, you know, have I got these right? That's what the life extension is, that these things are just getting old and we're taking the cobwebs out of them? Or how would you characterize it?
Well, the drumbeat is always safe, secure, and reliable. You saw that in the administration guidance. They advocate for maintaining a safe, secure, reliable deterrent through this proposed campaign, because it might not necessarily happen, proposed campaign of nuclear reductions. My concern with maintaining the stockpile is that some of these life extension programs are quite ambitious. So, for instance, when you're combining the pits of the W-78 warhead and the W-88 warheads, and you want an interoperable warhead that is going to deal with two different telemetries, you know, when they're land-based and sea-based, I am concerned with how the NNSA will retain the integrity of the physics package. The integrity of the plutonium pit. And because I would like to see the United States ratify the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty one of these days, so I always get jittery when I see aggressive life extension programs that tinker with the physics package, because I always think, I wonder if there is a limit to subcritical testing and verifying the performance of that warhead. So
they're tweaking with how the bomb works to a greater extent than just pulling out the cobwebs. And there's a question in your mind about have they altered it so much that we can't be sure they're going to work right? Is that what you're saying?
That's absolutely what I'm saying. This week is an incredible milestone for America. It's July 3rd is the 20th anniversary of President Clinton announcing extension of the nuclear test moratorium in America. I think it's an incredibly good thing, and I would like to see eventually the United States ratify the CTBT. I don't think that that's going to happen in this administration.
CPBT, comprehensive.
The Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. Exactly. And so I would like to see all of the conditions for ratification come about before it's introduced in the Senate and they try for ratification again. And one of those conditions is that we don't have these life extension programs that might threaten the integrity of the warhead.
And can you help us relate this somehow to the Kansas City plant and what they do? They make the non-nuclear components, 75% or 80% of them, we hear. For all of the U.S. nuclear weapons, why is spending going up, and what is the Kansas City plant's role in that?
Well, the Kansas City plant, as you know, is involved in non-nuclear component production, and it supplies support. It supports the mission of the B-61 warhead, the life extension program for the B-61 warhead, the LEP for the interoperable warhead I was talking about, the W-7888 interoperable warhead, and a host of other life extension programs, and also maintaining current warheads in the stockpile. And it does so through safety and surety devices. Just a very crude way of explaining that a safety and surety device. For instance, we've had the phenomenon of warheads that have found their way in crops in the rural South, and out of some grace, because of the safety and surety features on that warhead, it did not detonate, even though it
accidentally was dropped from a plane or something.
Yes, this has happened, and in the history of not recent history, but so it's a feature that prevents detonation. It is a very necessary, I would say, maintain a very necessary feature. I don't think, however, that we need a triad. So then, which is a different argument. So then I guess I would maintain that we don't need non-nuclear components and safety and surety devices for, three legs of a triad and the myriad of warheads that accompany that triad. So.
We've got a House Resolution 1960, fiscal year 2014, National Defense Authorization Bill, and some kind of preliminary form, and in these hundreds of pages, buried in there is something called Pilot Program to Additional Facilities of the Nuclear Security Enterprise that deals with the Kansas City plant of the NNSA here. Can you explain what's up with that?
Well, the Kansas City Pilot Program was an initiative that poured third-party certification into verification of health and safety standards, because the Kansas City plant is an electrical and mechanical manufacturing facility. They don't deal with fissile materials or high-risk materials. Then this was a way of saving money at this specific site. And from what I've looked into the pilot program, it works for a non-nuclear facility, absolutely. But when it was applied at high-risk sites such as Los Alamos in New Mexico, there was an incident involving a machinist who was exposed to toxic substances because of the program that was implemented. And this was brought up by a representative Vizi of Texas when it was discussed, because this is the chairman's mark that comes from the House Armed Services Committee, and the National Defense Authorization Bill has actually been passed in the House, so there's a final bill to that as well. And Representative Vizi, he attempted to remove the pilot program from the NDAA unsuccessfully, and then now the National Defense Authorization Act has been discussed in committee, in the Senate Armed Services Committee, and I have not seen a markup of the NDAA from the Senate yet. I think they could be discussing it in conference.
So we don't know what this final legislation will be. But I'm reading from the H.R. 1960 markup, which says the pilot program shifted away from reliance on directives of the Department of Energy and toward third-party certification and industrial standards whenever possible. And so, and if I'm having you repeat yourself, forgive me, but I want to be clear, is this... We're talking about some sort of private industry corporate approach as opposed to more stringent safeguards in the Department of Energy directives? Have I got that right?
Yes, I would consider the Department of Energy's Office of Health, Safety, and Security. The directives coming out of that office are very stringent and would perhaps rival that of rival industrial standards, or perhaps be burdensome to a facility that only deals with producing non-nuclear components. However, it's not the case with Los Alamos National Lab. And I guess what got to me when I was watching the House floor discuss the Kansas City pilot plan was that Representative Rogers of Kentucky, I believe, he was saying that this program would save the complex $14 million. Well, when I open up the pages of my stockpile stewardship management plan for fiscal year 2014, and I see that we're spending nearly $14 billion on a life extension program, I kind of see where we need to cut, and it doesn't seem to be by using third-party industrial standards at Los Alamos.
Once again, that was independent researcher Alicia Dressman. This is Tom Clammer, and I'll be back with more after you. Listen to this. Welcome back to Tell Somebody. This is your host, Tom Clammer. In the first part of the show, we heard from Alicia Dressman, who talked about nuclear weapons life extension programs and the future of disarmament. A couple of more notes, more or less related. In GAO testimony before the Subcommittee on Strategic Forces, Committee on Armed Forces, U.S. Senate, dated May 8, 2013, Department of Energy, observations on project and program cost estimating in NNSA and the Office of Environmental Management, statement of David Trimble, Director, National Resources and Environment with the GAO. For more than a decade, GAO has reported on the challenges the Department of Energy's National Nuclear Security Administration, NNSA, and the Office of Environmental Management, EM, have faced in meeting their project's cost performance targets as developed in estimates and for ensuring that these cost estimates are based on sound assumptions. NNSA and EM are included on GAO's high-risk list in recognition of the potential for vulnerabilities to fraud, waste, abuse, and mismanagement in contract administration and management of major projects. In January 2010, GAO reported on DOE's project cost estimating practices and found that DOE did not have a cost estimating policy and that cost estimating guidance it had developed in the 1990s remained in effect but was out of date. To develop budget estimates for operating programs, NNSA has implemented a Planning, Programming, Budgeting, and Evaluation, PPBE, process, which provides a framework for the agency to plan, prioritize, fund, and evaluate program activities. In particular, NNSA's PPBE policy includes a process by which the agency reviews the cost estimating practices used by its contractors and its program office to validate future budget requests. In June 2010, GAO reported on NNSA's program to operate and maintain weapons facilities and infrastructure and found that NNSA could not accurately identify the total costs of this program's activity. GAO determined that for fiscal year 2009, the costs of the activities associated with this program totaled over $500 million more than the budget request for it. Building on these findings, in July 2012, GAO reported on NNSA's implementation of its PPBE process, particularly in the area of validating programs' budget requests, and found deficiencies that GAO concluded affect the credibility and reliability of these estimates. And how about this one? In a memorandum from the Department of Energy Inspector General, this memorandum for the Secretary of the Department of Energy, dated April 17, 2013, titled Special Report on Management and Operating Contractors Subcontract Audit Coverage. The Department of Energy employs 28 management and operating, or M&O, contractors that perform essential mission work under cost-reimbursable contracts. To achieve the department's mission, M&O contractors often utilize the services of subcontractors, which are also funded by the department. When these subcontracts are structured as cost type, including time and materials, and cost reimbursable subcontracts, M&O contractors are contractually required to ensure that associated costs incurred are audited to provide assurance that the costs are allowable. The M&O contractors may use their internal audit staff, engage contract auditors, or use the services of the Defense Contract Audit Agency, the DCAA, to audit the subcontractors. Internally performed audits must, at a minimum, meet professional standards prescribed by the Institute of Internal Auditors. M&O contractors presumably rely on audits of subcontractors when completing required annual certifications that all of their incurred costs are allowable. And it goes on with some results. Between 2010 and 2012, the Office of Inspector General reported subcontract audit weaknesses with 9 M&O contractors. Subcontracts valued in excess of $906 million had not been audited or were reviewed in a manner that did not meet audit standards. Several examples included: the subcontract costs were not audited because the department did not ensure that its M&O contractors developed and implemented procedures to meet their contractual requirements. Specifically, although the M&O contractors are contractually required to conduct or arrange for audits of their cost-type subcontracts, we determined that 4 of the 9 M&O contractors that had not audited their subcontracts failed to develop an approach to meet their contractual requirement for audit. For example, at the Kansas City plant, we found that the contractor, although required to arrange for audits of its subcontractors, had almost $20 million in subcontract costs that had not been audited because there were no internal procedures for auditing ongoing subcontracts. So, I'm no CPA, but that doesn't sound like sterling performance. I wonder why the Wall Street Journal didn't write about this. But if I'm reading this all right, Honeywell apparently still gets a bonus in addition to the pittance it receives for operating the Kansas City Nuclear Weapons Parts Plant. I came on a PDF of a typed-in form called Amendment of Solicitation / Modification of Contract, issued by NNSA, Kansas City Site Office, U.S. Department of Energy. Name and address of contractor: Honeywell, attention John Murray, P.O. Box 419159, Kansas City, Missouri 64141-6159. Description of amendment or modification. The purpose of this modification is to update Section B to reflect the amount of incentive fee earned in fiscal year 2012, yada, yada, yada. Table 1 is updated to reflect the amount of incentive fee that was actually awarded to the contractor for the period October 1, 2011, through September 30, 2012. The term TBD, presumably that's to be determined, is replaced with $28,755,000. Section B5 is updated to show the current obligation of funds $1,916,305,826.17, period of performance 10/1/2010 to 9/30/2013. And now for something completely different. Or maybe not. Salon.com, June 18th, 2013. Bank of America whistleblowers bombshell. We were told to lie. Bank of America's mortgage servicing unit systematically lied to homeowners, fraudulently denied loan modifications, and paid their staff bonuses for deliberately pushing people into foreclosure. Yes, these allegations were suspected by any homeowner who ever had to deal with the bank to try to get a loan modification, but now they come from six former employees and one contractor whose sworn statements were added last week to a civil lawsuit filed in federal court in Massachusetts. Bank of America. And how about this one? Jeff Olson, California man, faces 13 years in jail for writing anti-big bank messages in chalk. Jeff Olson, a 40-year-old man from San Diego, California, will face jail time for charges stemming from anti-big bank messages he scrawled in water-soluble chalk outside Bank of America branches last year. The San Diego Reader reported Tuesday that a judge had decided to prohibit Olson's attorney from mentioning the First Amendment, free speech, free expression, public forum, expressive conduct, or political speech during the trial. With that ruling, Olson must now stand trial on 13 counts of vandalism, charges that together carry a potential 13-year jail sentence and fines of up to $13,000. Wait, there's some good news there. SanDiegoReader.com yesterday, July 1st, acquitted on all 13 counts of vandalism. Jury says Jeff Olson should be free. On Monday, jurors rejected all 13 counts of vandalism charges filed against Olson for scribbling anti-Bank of America messages in water-soluble chalk. Now, as if all of this didn't already belong in the "you've got to be kidding me" department, I think the reaction of the judge and prosecutor to Olson's refusal to take a plea bargain certainly does. Reading still from the SanDiegoReader.com, it was a good day for Olson and Tosdell and for free speech supporters across the country. Not so much for San Diego City Attorney Jan Goldsmith in his office and for Superior Court Judge Howard Shore. After the verdicts were read, Judge Shore explained the reasoning behind his decision to bar Tosdell from using First Amendment rights as a defense, as well as for placing a gag order on the defendant prohibiting him from speaking to the media. "The media set the tone in this case, talking about a potential 13-year sentence. It had a tendency to infuriate the public instead of informing it. Anyone in the system, the lawyers and anyone involved, knew that maximum sentence would never be handed out, but still it was reported." Close quote. Looking at those offers, however, fair is one of the last words that comes to mind. On May 16th, Hazard told Olson the city would drop the case if he agreed to serve 32 hours of community service, attend an 8-hour seminar by the Corrective Behavior Institute, pay Bank of America $6,299 in restitution for the cleanup, waive all Fourth Amendment rights guarding against search and seizures, and surrender his driver's license for 3-year period. Olson refused. So, on June 18th, as the June 25th trial date neared, Hazard offered Olson another deal. Olson would plead guilty to one count of vandalism, agree to serve 3 years probation, pay restitution, amount undetermined, spend 24 hours cleaning up the graffiti, and surrender his driver's license for 2 years. Can't imagine why he wouldn't take that deal. Bank of America. KCPT is pleased to air an encore presentation of the Bank of America celebration at the station. This free Memorial Day weekend event in the Midwest returned for its 10th anniversary. The Kansas City Symphony, led by music director Michael Stern, performed patriotic favorites against the backdrop of Kansas City's historic Union Station on May 27, 2012. Bank of America celebration at the station concluded with the most blazing fireworks display of the year. That's from the KCPT.org website. Watch an encore presentation on July 4th at 8:30 p.m. Yeah, watch this if you get a chance. It will also air over the weekend on KCPT2. Check the schedules at kcpt.org. The music is wonderful. But think about all the PR that Bank of America gets here. And if you watch it, see if they re-air the interview with the Bank of America executive at intermission. Now, don't get me wrong. I ain't knocking KCPT just to be knocking it. I do believe that public television should be supported. There is some wonderful stuff there. But support should not be blind, silent, and uncritical. Should the mission of public television, nationally and in Kansas City, be to provide cover for criminal corporations like Bank of America, Walmart, Coca-Cola? Don't they buy enough of that on commercial television without KCPT feeling it has to prostitute itself to them? Go to contact information at kcpt.org and let them know what you think. In the few minutes we have left, I'm going to play a few minutes from the remarks Glenn Greenwald made via Skype to the Socialism 2013 conference in Chicago last week regarding Edward Snowden's revelations about the NSA's mass surveillance program. You can watch a video of the entire event at wearemany.org.
So the last point I want to make is that I think that one of the things that I know I set out to do, and I think that Mr. Snowden set out to do, and that I know the people at The Guardian set out to do, was not simply to publish some stories about the NSA. It was to really shake up the foundations of the corrupted and rotted roots of America's political and media culture. And the reason I say that is that there's an economist, Dean Baker, who yesterday on Twitter wrote that he thinks that the stories that we're doing are shining as much light on the corruption of American journalism as they are on the ongoing operations of the National Security Agency. And I think that is true for several different reasons. Number one is that if you look at the quote-unquote debate over the very charming, endearing debate about whether or not I should be arrested, prosecuted, and then imprisoned under espionage statutes for doing journalism, what you find is that debate is being led by other people who are TV actors who play the role of journalists on TV. They're the ones who are actually in the debate. And the reason that they're doing that is because they purport to be adversaries of political power or watchdogs over political power, but what they really are servants to political power. They're appendages of political power. And so what you find is that they always lead the way in attacking whoever challenges the political system in Washington, because that is the system of which they're a part. That's the system that props them up, gives them oxygen, and provides them with all of their privilege, wealth, and access. And I think their true role, which is not to serve as adversaries of people in government power or to expose what they're doing, but to protect and shield them and amplify their message, has become more vividly exposed in the last 4 weeks than it has in quite a long time. And the thing that really amazes me is that if you look at how whistleblowers are treated, whether it be Bradley Manning or WikiLeaks or Thomas Drake at the NSA or Edward Snowden, I can understand why Americans in general, just ordinary Americans, have ambivalence about those whistleblowers. Some people think security is more important, or that secrecy is something that should be decided by democratically elected officials and not by individual whistleblowers. That I all get. But what I don't understand and can never believe is that anybody who at any point thought of themselves as somebody who had a journalistic ethos would look at people who are shining light on the world's most powerful factions and do anything but applaud them and express gratitude for them, since that's supposed to be the function that they, the journalists themselves, are serving. And yet what you find is the exact opposite. What you really find is that if you look at who hates Bradley Manning, or who has expressed the most contempt about WikiLeaks, or who has led the chorus in demonizing Edward Snowden, it is those very people in the media who pretend to want transparency, because transparency against political power is exactly what they don't want, because those are their masters. And the stronger they stay, and the stronger that system stays, the more rewarded they will be. And what is really amazing most of all about it is that while they purport to hate leaks, they themselves are the most prolific users of leaks. I was on Meet the Press last week, the first time I ever ventured into the belly of the imperial beast. And some of you probably know, but it got a lot of attention because David Gregory all but called for my prosecution during the interview. And you know, the reason why, there were a lot of reasons why that was pretty amazing, but one of the most extraordinary things about it was that 90 seconds or so before he actually called for my prosecution, because I committed the crime of doing journalism, of showing what the public what the government is doing in the dark, he and I had an argument about a FISA court opinion that had been issued in 2011 that found many of the things that the National Security Agency was doing to be unconstitutional and illegal. And I had described this opinion based on the documents that I have in my possession that talks about them. And he objected and he said, oh no, the way you've described this opinion is not accurate. I've had government officials tell me that what's actually in this opinion was not a finding that the government did anything wrong or illegal or unconstitutional. Perish the thought. This was nothing more than the government going to the court and saying, can we please have permission to do this spying that we would like to do in the future but haven't yet done? And the government said, the court said, no, you're allowed to do this and this and this, but not this and this and this. And then the government went and obeyed the court. Now, David Gregory's claims about what that court opinion were completely false, as I well know, because I've actually seen documents talking about them, as opposed to having government officials whisper in my ear what it says. But what was really amazing about it was that 90 seconds later, he was calling for my prosecution for having disclosed classified information, and yet he, 90 seconds earlier, had just gotten done saying that somebody in the government had come to him and described this top secret court document, which he then disclosed to the public and to the world by telling me what he thought it said. The same exact thing happened on CNN when Barbara Starr, who is the Pentagon spokeswoman who...
Well, that's it. We're out of time. You've been listening to the podcast edition of Tell Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us. Comments or questions? Send me an email to mail@tellsomebody.us. You can also follow me on Twitter at Tell Somebody Now. The Tell Somebody podcast is produced and distributed by Tell Somebody and may or may not reflect the broadcast of Tell Somebody, heard Tuesdays at 6 p.m. Central Time on 90.1 FM KKFI in Kansas City, streaming around the world at www.kkfi.org. If you haven't heard Tell Somebody before, I hope you'll listen again. Check out the podcast and the broadcast. Click on a tile at www.tellsomebody.us for a link to a past show. If you enjoyed the show and appreciated the information you got from it, please tell somebody about the podcast and the broadcast. Spread the word to your friends and contacts by word of mouth or Facebook, Twitter, email list, or any other way you can think of. Big thanks, as always, to Niloufar Movahedi. This is Tom Clammer. I'll see you next week on Tell Somebody.